Well, I know some folks are still looking for a seat.
We could double up.
If there's anybody willing, no, I'm not going to even. That's, you know, that's going down a road I'm not willing to go down. I will start, though, I think, just in the interest of holding to the schedule here this morning. And this morning, I'm going to be talking about a favorite poem of mine. And you know, before I do that, let's everybody just sit for a second. And maybe just let your eyes close. And just be here for a moment. I just want to remind you that you are alive. The warmth of your body, your mind buzzing with thoughts, and your heart beating in your chest, the blood moving through all those miles of veins, so if you're having a wonderful Sunday today, or if you come here today with a troubled mind or a broken heart, beyond all of those things, you are alive. And that's pretty good. That is pretty good. Okay, thank you. I just thought that would be a good starting place. So, this morning I will be talking about a favorite poem of mine. I recently did a 30-day solo retreat, and I noticed that it arose in my mind over and over during the course of my month alone. And so I kind of thought I'd bring it back and share it with you. And all the inferred teaching here is my own. I'm certainly not intending to suggest that this poem was written with Zen practice in mind or with any kind of Buddhist message. I'm certain that it wasn't. But when we've been practicing for a time, we begin to see that the Dharma is undivided. You know, it is boundless. It's not limited to the Zen talk, or the Zen center, or the Buddhist website, or the sutra. It is everywhere. And so I'm just using this poem this morning as my jumping off place. And it's on the front of your programs, but I will read it aloud for those of you who don't have one. The poem is by James Wright, whom I'm sure a lot of you know. And it's called Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. Over my head, I see the bronze butterfly, asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines. The droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. A chicken hawk floats over, looking for home. I have wasted my life. So, James Wright is an American poet, and he lived from 1927 to 1980. He lived here in the cities for some years. He taught at the U of M and at McAllister. And he was a longtime friend of Robert Bly. And in 1972, his collected poems won the Pulitzer Prize. So as I say, I'm sure a lot of you have heard of James Wright and are probably familiar with this poem. And I first read this, I was trying to think of when I first came across it. I'm guessing it was about 1990. I was taking a poetry class at the U of M, and our professor, Michael Dennis Brown, another poet, was an Englishman, and he told our class he moved to America because of this poem. Now, an Englishman, he studied mostly British and European literature, and when he read this, he went, oh, they're doing things over there. I should go over there. So I think in a way, I came to Zen practice a couple years after first reading this poem, but it was the first poem I memorized. I really wanted to memorize this, so I kind of kept it inside of me. And I actually think it's kind of informed my practice. I'm kind of guessing. So I'll talk about it today, and we'll see what happens. And we'll start with the title, Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. So that's a long title, right? That is a long title for actually a pretty short poem. And he could very easily have called it Lying in a Hammock, right? Or Nice Day. Or there's a lot of ways he could have gone with that. And there's something about the specificity of the title that brings us into the immediate experience that he's having, right? It's such a specific place and a specific time. Lying in a hammock at William Duffy's farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. That brings us right to a very vivid present. And, of course, the poem itself is written in the present tense. It is unfolding as we read it, right? He's not saying, I remember once when I was lying in, or I would love someday to lie in. It's I am, and it's unfolding as we read it, right? So the whole thing is locked into the present. It's entirely locked into the present. And our first sentence, over my head, I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. So in that one sentence, he mentions three different colors, as well as wind, the sensation of wind. We know he feels that, along with the butterfly being blown. And the fact he's mentioning so much of the sensory input, our senses, they are our gate to the present, I say. And they're also, they're really our gate to the deathless and the birthless and the timeless moment, right? It's not necessarily that, in fact, I'll get rid of the necessarily. It's not that there's a present moment that is distinguished from past moments or future moments, and we are trying to stay here as opposed to there. There is just the present moment, right? That's what Zen teaches us. And sometimes when I'm upstairs on the third floor teaching intro to Zazen, I will find myself saying, one of the reasons we come back to posture in Zazen, come back to breathing in Zazen, is because all of our senses are locked. They're our anchor to the present moment, right? And I'll say, only your mind can wander. Which is true in a sense. And I think in an intro type setting, that's kind of helpful for people to notice, oh, my mind can wander to the past or to the future, but my body never can. This breath is always now, right? I can't take it twice. Oh, that's the present. Always. But strictly speaking, your mind can't wander to the past or the future. You can have memories, perhaps, impressions of what you imagine it might have been or might be, but those are happening now. Your mind can't wander. Your body can't wander. Nothing can wander. There's just this, right? So he's totally in just sensory input. Just sensory input. It's unflowing as we're reading it. And even the phrase, and I kind of go back and forth about this because, you know, we still say the present moment, but in a way that's misleading because it sort of suggests, well, there are other moments from which to choose. And there aren't. I mean, show me another moment. You can't. You can't even show me the moment when you walked in the Zendo. That was just a little while ago. You can't. You'll be leaving shortly. You can't show me that either. Isn't that weird? But it's true. It's true. Oh, my mind was wandering to the future. Well, not really. So, there is no here apart from now. And there's no now apart from here. And we talk about time as being separate from space because it's convenient to do so. But ultimately, of course, those are not two things. So his second sentence. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. So behind the empty house. It's interesting he included the word empty. Isn't it? He could easily have said house. But that just reminds us no one's home. He's alone. He's alone in his moment, as we all are. Buddhism teaches us that ultimately we have nothing upon which to depend. That we go in to the world alone and we leave it alone. And that's true, of course. In another sense, we're never alone, and the idea of alone itself is absurd. We couldn't possibly be separate. But what I like about the word empty here is, of course, it's just a description of the house, but in our practice, we go through a felt experience of being alone, of being lonely. In fact, even if you don't have a practice, everybody knows the feeling of loneliness. But within a Zen context or a spiritual practice-based context, loneliness is one of the doors we have to go through. We have to go through it. Tim gave a couple talks some years ago about needing to go through loneliness to get to aloneness. You know, the ability to be upright alone is okay. You're alone, and that's actually fine. You know, and Buddhism says you're alone. They're not giving you bad news, right? They're giving you a fact. So it's interesting that so many of us interpret that as, oh, it's terrible. Like, well, you're the one who's adding that terrible. Why would that be terrible? But for a lot of us, at least in some phases and some times in our lives, it is terrible. It's very difficult. So there's that phase in practice where we need to move through. We need to be with loneliness long enough to allow it to transform into the okayness that comes from being alone. And then the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. Distances of the afternoon is merging space and time again. Right? Afternoon is time. Distances is obviously space. The afternoon can't have distances. And yet he's doing that same thing again of going, there's no time apart from space, there's no space apart from time. And so we're really reminded again that to separate these things is ultimately an illusion. And I'm wondering if perhaps for him, the sound of the cowbells actually heightens his experience of the silence. Have you guys had that experience where it's really quiet, you're sitting by the lake, and all of a sudden a bird goes, and you realize, wow, it's quiet out here. It like took the to realize I've been really quiet. And of course, the reason is because you're up here in the noise of your head, you know, the chatter, chatter, chatter. The bird called just for a second, pulls you right back into the present, right? There's your senses, your hearing going, oh, right. And before you go back to the narrative, you have that second of going, oh, it's so quiet, right? Because you're still listening, and now there's no bird call. There's just silence. It was there the whole time, but you've had this little bird help you by reminding you. And we do a lot of silence here at Zen Center, of course. Contemplative, intentional silence is a crucial part of a meditative practice. It's one of the things I love most about this place. There's a real value placed on intentional silence in meditation. And there's a number of reasons for that, of course, but one of the things that I'm reminded of is that it's almost a way of making sure we remember that silence is first, that it's primary. You know, silence is primary. It's underneath all the sounds. It surrounds all the sounds. It was here first. I was thinking, I was reading recently about how it was funny that when the Big Bang Theory was first invented, that they called it the Big Bang. I'm like, that's funny. Couldn't possibly have been sound. There wasn't oxygen. It would have just been a flash of light, but we call it Big Bang. Isn't that interesting? Because silence is first. Silence, 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 right? Silence is the thing that comes before all of your sounds. It comes after all of your sounds. It's in between all of your sounds. And I also like to remind myself of that, especially during retreat here during the summer when the windows are open and the radios are on, right? And cars are accelerating rapidly from our stop sign here. And it's, if you guys would shut up, we could have some stillness. I try to remind myself, well, no, the stillness is just here, right? No matter how loud the noise is, no matter how long it's sustained, it can't cut silence, it can't stain silence, it can't ruin silence. It can't, right? Silence is just present, surrounding, supporting everything. And, you know, from a Zen point of view, we're made of it. We are made. Over and over we talk about emptiness, spaciousness, silence. And it's like the sky, this silence that he's hearing. It is holding the sound of the cowbells and the birds, but it's not limited to any of those. So it's much like the sky in that way. And I think in real life, by which I mean when your mind is quiet and you can see a little bit more clearly, everything is actually really quiet and very deliberate. When your mind gets still, you see how deliberate the world is. And with that deliberateness comes sort of there's a quietness, I think, to that. Tim said in a talk once some years ago, the mind is intrinsically quiet. It's intrinsically totally still. And I listened to that whole talk. That line jumped out at me, and so I wrote it down and put it on my steering wheel. That's what I do. If there's something that really needs to be unraveled, I put it on my steering wheel. I look at it at red lights and that kind of stuff. So he said that, and I thought, well, he must be talking about his mind. I mean, maybe he doesn't know me well enough. I should probably tell him the next time I see him in Dokusan, my mind is not intrinsically quiet or totally still. It is never intrinsically quiet. But no, he assures me that it actually is. In the last two lines of one of the English translations I have of the canon, the 10-verse canon sutra, Compassion Sutra, is, this moment arises from mind. This moment itself is mind. So without going down the mind-only Buddhism road, this moment arises from mind. If mind is totally silent, if it's still, the moment arises from stillness, the moment is stillness. So we're not talking about literal, not moving stillness, right? And we're not talking about silence that means no sound. We're talking about something else, a quality of being. So our third sentence. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, The droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. So here we have another color, and we have a mention of change and impermanence with last year's horses. Even if those horses are still around, off in the barn someplace, they aren't the same. Those are not the same horses. The ones who were in the field and left those droppings last year belong to last year. And again, the opposite is true, that they are forever connected, as we all are, to the eternal now. The droppings blazing up into golden stones. You know, with that, the horses of last year are not separate from this moment. In fact, the horses of last year and the golden stones aren't two things. There's still only one thing happening in the poem. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. And this is an interesting line. The evening is darkening, so again, we're just talking about senses. But as a reader, as me, I kind of wonder if there's a feeling starting, perhaps melancholy, with the end of the day and the end of the evening. Maybe even perhaps a pulling back from his experience a little. Maybe he's not arrested by his experience the way he has been. It isn't unusual for us to experience all sorts of surprising emotions when our minds and hearts get still. Well, everybody who's done a long retreat knows that, to some extent anyway. Fascinatingly, when things become still in our heart mind, we oftentimes experience emotion. And of course, you know, when we're new to practice, we have a tendency to say, wow, like, let's say sadness comes up. Oh, that Zazen made me sad. Well, no, of course, Zazen didn't make you sad, but Zazen helped things quiet down enough so you could feel what was already there. Right? We store so much in those veils that we have around our hearts, around our bodies, around our minds, that when the chatter that distracts us from them quiets just enough, we can finally be present to them. You know, thank goodness, right? What a gift. I mean, really, whatever, even if what comes up is painful, you get to see it now. Now you get to see it, right? Even if it's, you at least get to bear witness to that part of yourself that's alive down there, you know? And we know from practice that unless we see something, unless we are aware of something, it can't transform. It can't. It's just down there. It's stuck until you see it, right? It's the light of awareness itself that starts to move these things, to allow them to change. So we can be sad for years and not know it, strangely. I'm sure, I mean, I'm seeing nodding. I know a lot of you know what I'm talking about. Or angry for years, or, you know, joy can come up. We don't know. But there's something about when the chatter starts to still that we get to see it. And our challenge then, of course, is to really allow it to be there, to not notice it and go and want to push it away again, but to really be present to it. Because, of course, you know, running from stuff is pointless, and at some point we really figure that out. There's just no point in running. So the fifth sentence, a chicken hawk floats over looking for home. So the chicken hawk is another solo wanderer, just like our narrator. Just like all of us. And just like all of us, he's looking for home. I mean, looking for home is actually what everybody's doing here this morning. That's why you're here. Regardless of what your reason is for being here, that's your reason for being here. It's really the reason for everything that we do. That makes sense. That makes sense to me. And, you know, home, of course, is just that sense of being deeply content, okay with being alive, like truly okay. Truly okay. Just, you know, in the midst of the storm, despite the externals, just being, right? We could say comfortable in your own skin, or, I don't know, there's a lot of words for that. Looking for home. And we look for home, of course, in our relationships and in our jobs and in our spiritual practice and in our thought patterns. We look for that feeling in the entertainment we seek out. Or, I mean, everything we do is ultimately about, right, wanting to touch that place. So it's interesting also to note that everything so far in the poem, because we've done the entire poem now except the last line, every single thing in it has been just observation. There have been no opinions, no judgments, right? No ideas, no concepts, no interpretation, just observation. Isn't that interesting? I didn't know that until I was writing this talk, and I was like, he's just describing. He's not saying, I feel lonely, I feel hopeful, I feel nothing. It's just description. As it's unfolding, he's just recording his experience. So even, oh, blazing up into golden stones, that feeling that I get in my chest is mine. He's not giving that to me, right? He's just saying, well, the droppings that did used to be ugh are now something else, right? But he's carefully not using ugh, because that's a judgment. That's an interpretation. That's an opinion, right? So no opinions, no judgments. So to use the Buddhist term that I'm sure all of you probably know, even if you've never been here before, mindfulness. He's describing mindful awareness, right? Which is just the state of observing the field of experience without the judgment, without the interpretations, without the opinion, without the agenda, just seeing it, right? So it's funny that just observation, even at this point in the poem, we're already left with a really, and I'm sure different for all of us, but a very distinct feeling tone. There's a very distinct feeling tone that's already been, in a sense you could say, conveyed accidentally, but just by describing his experience. So, mindful awareness. Not positive, not negative, but just there. So then we come to the last line. I have wasted my life. And this is the unexpected punch, sort of, at the end of the poem. One of the reasons I wanted to print it out today, I'm very visual. I would much prefer to read a poem than to hear a poem. That's just the way my brain is wired. And I find it fascinating. He didn't leave a space between those last two lines. It's like, ding, 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 ding. Done. Like a space would somehow have put too much emphasis on it. Because he's just going down. And then Chicken Hawk, I've wasted my life. The end. Because it comes out of nowhere. I mean, it's such a blindsiding line. Like, what? How did this lead there? Isn't it? I mean, it's out of nowhere. Yeah, it is out of nowhere. And the last line makes the poem. I mean, it does. Without that line, it's just a description of stuff that may or may not be nice. The reason the poem is a poem is because of that line. And it may work for you as a teaching line. It may not. That's fine. But this is the only opinion he expresses. It's the only judgment he expresses. It's the only evaluation. And it's not just an evaluation or an opinion about that moment, the chicken hawk or the cows or the droppings. It is a blanket judgment about his entire existence. Isn't that amazing? This moment in the hammock has led him to say, my entire existence up to this point has been a waste. Wow. That's pretty harsh. I put it to you that is pretty harsh. And when I read it, I think, oh, yeah, I can see where you got there. Like, that seems fair. Like, yeah, I can imagine that. I've had those moments. Sure, I know that. And in another way, I'm like, that's horrifically unfair. It is. It's shocking. It's, like, shockingly absurd to think your life has been wasted. How is that even possible? And we don't know. I mean, he's wise enough to end it there and walk away. Because he doesn't go on to interpret that feeling to say, I've had a moment of mindful presence, and I regret all the moments that I wasn't mindful and present. You know, or he's not saying, I vow to now change. I'm going to change. I'm really going to be. We don't know if it's a lighthearted. You know, sometimes we can say stuff like that to ourselves with almost a smile. God, I've wasted my life. you know, it's actually okay. There's almost an affection toward ourselves around it. Or if it's a, I don't know. We really don't know where he is. I've always suspected that that moment was probably one of those turning moments that we have, that perhaps something's going to change. I don't know. But he has awareness. He has an awareness of something. I was reminded a little bit of, because I was watching a TV show last night that talked about the Apollo missions. And I know all of you know this, but the very first time that the capsule went around the moon and they watched the Earth rise over the surface of the moon and took that photo, Earth rise, I guess they call it, the photo of the Earth coming up. And that sort of feeling of, you know, kind of indescribable awe of seeing essentially everything. I mean, through the light of human consciousness, you're looking at every possible thing there is. There it is, all in one little dot. There's almost like this shocking change of perspective of going, I have wasted my life. Like, I really thought getting that promotion was super important. And you see all of creation, you know, that you could cover with your thumb. And all of a sudden you go, wow, you've just been exposed to a perspective where nothing else has made sense. It's a brand new operating system. So it could be that type of feeling. It might not be, it could be any number of things. But he feels he's wasted his life. And that is a feeling that I know some of us are familiar with. That's a horrible feeling. And ultimately speaking, which is my favorite perspective from which to try to speak. he hasn't wasted his life. He hasn't. He absolutely hasn't. He's describing a feeling state. He's describing a feeling state. I feel regret. I feel sad. I feel small. I feel something, right? But his interpretation, his mental interpretation, consciousness, that's the fifth skanda for those of you who are into this type of stuff, that interpretation comes out as the sentence, I have wasted my life, which is, number one, untrue. And again, it's absurd. It's shocking and absurd. And he could believe it. I mean, he could inhabit that and really believe it. And I know a lot of us do. We believe things that are that hysterically untrue about ourselves. Well, that's our operating system. Yep. It's not true, but that's where I live. But of course, no life, no moment, no effort is ever lost or wasted. Ever. It can't be. It is impossible. It is impossible. So to say that some parts of our life are well spent and other parts of our life are wasted, at very best, that's a superficial truth. But really, to say that is a terrifying judgment. That is a terrifying judgment, and we do it all the time, don't we? Oh, I wasted the whole afternoon. Really? What would that look like? You wasted it. How is that? Wow. Saying that cuts us off from who we are. Completely cuts us off from who we really are, doesn't it? It just cuts us off from the vast extent of being alive. And we don't get to amputate anything. In true practice, in true Zen practice, we don't get to cut off anything, ever. It's always about seeing, incorporating, integrating, including, allowing, taming, transforming. Do you know what I mean? It's not, that's bad, it's out. We never get to do that. We just don't. And you can see why, kind of, right? Intuitively, you can sort of see why. We don't get to cut things, people, experiences off because we don't like them, because they're uncomfortable, because we judge them. It's our practice to become bigger, right? To just hold a little more. Don't leave anything out. Don't leave anything behind. That's our job. So that regret, oh, I see the regret. Can I be big enough in this moment to just be with the feeling of regret? I don't have to believe the narrative, I've wasted my life. I don't have to amputate that whole part of me. Joko Beck, he's a wonderful Zen teacher, She said, our practice must be careful, meticulous, patient. We must face everything. So this is actually our vow to free all beings. That's really what this is. This is the vow to free all beings. This is also really the first precept. I vow not to kill. I vow not to kill. If you think you've wasted something, your money, your time, or your life, that's a very powerful feeling. That's a horrible feeling. But that judgment itself is a lie. Right? And it's selling you short. It's selling your life short. It's trying to make you smaller. And so we treat things like that in our practice the way we treat everything. We allow them. I see you. I see you there. Yep. I'm not going to feed you. I'm not going to feed you. I'm not going to make you a little room in my house where you can live, but I will see you. Right? It's always that lovely dance we do between you don't push it away and you don't feed it. Allow it. It'll pass on its own time. It'll pass. So if you have this feeling, regret, for example, today, or anger or sadness or anything that arises in you, please don't kill it. Please don't kill it. Just give it its life. Allow it its life. It's not going to hurt you. It's not going to stain you. Don't worry about it. You're bigger than that. You're unstainable. Just allow it. It'll go. It'll go when it's time. It'll go. So, all of our experiences are okay to have. All of them are okay. Everything belongs. And the last thing I'll say about the poem is that the other way of seeing this last line is that this is what he's finally pulling back from his experience. Right? He's in the experience, and then suddenly he pulls back from it. Isn't that interesting? And that's when, of course, the interpretation comes, the judgment, right, comes. It's when he pulls back from his actual experience. So it'd be nice if you were there with him to say, okay, so instead of the whole waste your life thing, look at the colors there of those, you know, clouds behind the da-da-da-da. Where's your breath right now? He's essentially stopped giving himself away. You know, the whole poem, he's just in the experience. He's completely giving everything to the experience. And then when he pulls back, that's when he begins to constrict and suffer. And giving ourselves away is what we're here to do. That is the essence of our practice. Giving ourselves away is where we lose ourselves and where we find ourselves. And that's our intimacy. So as Dogen said, please do not waste this precious life. And to close today, my wish for all of us, like this poet, is to be present to beauty and to be present to ugliness. Be present to joy, please. Be present to regret. You know, be present long enough and carefully and gently enough and thoroughly enough until you forget entirely the words beauty, ugly, joy, regret, right? My wish for all of us is to be present enough to see clearly for ourselves that the endless flow of moment is our own true face. Thank you very much. And we're not doing questions or comments today, so I don't know what I'm doing. Am I turning it over to you?
Yeah. Oh.